Kevin.
My apologies.
I'm very happily out here listening to the bird sounds.
This is an amazing space. You
know, this is going to turn me into like a bird watcher.
Bro. Well, come to the city with birds, man.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Great.
This is, wow.
It's nice
this
out
is
here.
Such a, how did you know about this?
My first interview is going to be in Karen, so I just found the hotel in Karen, which is a little crazy because it's not quite Nairobi.
No, Karen has never been Nairobi.
No.
Yeah.
It is very, I think it's, well, this is where Out of Africa was written, and this feels a little bit like out of Nairobi. At least.
One of the things, one of the unnerving things that you first realize as a foreigner visiting Nairobi is that many of your cohort, those other foreigners landing at Jomo Kenyatta Airport, seem to be looking right past the humans of Kenya. They're looking for animals. Nairobi is the world's busiest transit hub for safari goers. I am not here for animals, but Nairobi's wildlife is hard to ignore. In Karen, the district I'm staying in, named after the colonist Karen Blixen, who wrote Out of Africa nearby, the birds bring the safari to you. Kestrels and crakes and bee-eaters and bustards, sooty falcons and Jackson's widow birds all circle and sing. But I stand firm. It's the people I'm most interested in. And if I've found anything in two decades as a foreign correspondent and day drinker, it's that humans are endlessly fascinating, complicated, and occasionally even delightful. Case in point, this episode's guest, Kevin Wachiro. An openly gay athlete in a country where gay relationships are illegal, a survivor of a rare cancer who is also the sunniest person I have met in ages. Kevin was a guest on one of the last episodes of Parts Unknown when Bourdain and W. Kamau Bell came to Kenya, and it is my pleasure to have him, like Tony and Kamau before him, on this show. Now, Kevin and I had this conversation many months ago, but I'm recording this right now in an unsettling week for my country in 2021, a few days after a pro-Trump mob stormed the Capitol building in D.C. In the aftermath, Kenyan Daily Nation reporter Elvis Ondieki posed the question, who's the Banana Republic now? It's a painful, if insightful, turnabout, but I will say this. Kenyans, and many people I've run into around the world, seem to just know more than we do about how to find joy in their struggles, how to thrive even as their government crumbles around them. I am very much in the market for those kind of life skills at the moment. This is Nathan Thornburg, and from Roads and Kingdoms, you're listening to The Trip, drinking with exceptional people around the world. Kevin, what did you bring us to? To rescue me from my dire coffee situation.
Yeah, when you told me you've got instant coffee, I was like, I'm not doing instant coffee. I'm not a coffee connoisseur, but I'm a coffee snob. So I'm like, I live in a country that has great coffee.
Why would you? Yeah.
Yeah, and I remember a friend of mine came home one time and he asked for instant coffee. And I'm like, I don't have instant coffee. And he used to come over and sleep quite a bit. And I told him, if you really want instant coffee in my house, you'd better come with your own coffee. So he bought instant coffee.
So he brought the Sanka for the whole...
Yeah, something like that. And people used to come and ask me, you've got... Anytime anyone wanted instant coffee, I'm like, that's Leslie's coffee. Use Leslie's coffee and make it yourself because I'm not making you instant coffee.
I'm not getting involved in
I'm not getting involved
foolishness.
In this. Yeah, it did save me when I ran out of coffee, though.
Right, so every once in a while.
Yeah, a black coffee. Coffee from Java House. Java House is a Kenyan brand.
Okay.
Kenyan coffee house. And it's good coffee. It's good coffee.
Let's do it. I'm really excited about this.
I'm sorry we had a bumpy ride here, so it spilled a little bit.
We're getting a slightly slow start because, as I'm quickly learning in Nairobi, traffic dominates everything, and they're doing construction on the main road.
On Gong Road coming here.
It's wild out there.
I'd totally forgotten about that. So when we turned onto Gong Road, I'm like, God almighty. And then the taxi guy had to make a detour he had to go down Gong Road, onto another road, go up road, went through some other neighborhood. Others are about to still be on the road right now. And yeah. It's a Sunday. And then right. There's a huge church and people going to church and like...
It is, yeah, it's amazing. And up here, you know, in the hills, I'm like officially turning into a birder because it's so peaceful and there's 5,000 types of birds chirping away. But I do feel like I'm really getting robbed of some of that quintessential Nairobi experience as long as I stay kind of holed up here in Karen. Although I did have like an hour and 10-minute boda ride across town, which is it's like a combination of dirt biking and like sitting in traffic on the, you know, on the 10 freeway in LA.
Okay. No, I mean, boda bodas have saved Nairobians and getting round.
Yeah.
Uganda had them before us. But I use them when I can, as much as I can. And now there's an app called Safe Boda.
Yeah.
And I think Uber and Taxify, which are other apps, also have the motorbike option.
Yeah.
And
in case you actually have to get somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And it does help. And it also watches your wallet as well.
Yeah, that's right. It's going to be less of a, I mean, it was a very economical ride. I've never paid less for an hour and 10 minutes of like sheer heart pounding thrill ride, you know?
No, I mean, people have gone round it. I remember a friend of mine used to have a helmet. He had, before it wasn't mandatory to have helmets. So he got a helmet. He picked a boda guy and sort of trained him onto how to, and because he's a motorcyclist as well, on training him on just how to manage the road. And he's the only one he used to use. There were a couple of guys.
So he trained up his own boda dude to be a defensive driver. And
totally.
Like, wow.
Totally. Because you could get some crazy boda out there.
Yeah.
Crazy.
I do wonder. I wonder where on the boda spectrum my guy was. I did get hit in the head by a side view mirror of a truck.
Oh, Lord.
You know, because, well, but I had a helmet, which was good.
That's still.
It was a big smack because he was like cutting in front of a truck and he forgot that he had a, you know, a half tall white dude on the back of his bike. So this big like smack and I was like, wait a second, what's happening here? But we did get there alive. So, you know, so clearly he had some skills.
I know there are people who will not be seen anywhere near Boda Boda, but they have helped people get on time. They've helped people catch flights as well.
Yeah.
I know people who got out of taxis with their bags, held down a Boda Boda and got onto a Boda Boda. Dash to the airport.
Oh man, this is my getaway day. My flight is later tonight.
No, you're okay.
I'm having a vision of my future.
No, but it's Sunday, but Nairobi's unpredictable like that. But you should be good.
Okay, if not, we'll just put that bag on your knees and get to Boda. All right, so this coffee is great. This is exciting, and I remember feeling about. You know, like Colombians, God love them, make incredible coffee, you know, Juan Valdez on down. But the national passion was instant coffee. And it was always just very confusing. But it's one of those things where you have this, you know, kind of it's a commodity. It's a really valuable commodity, easy to export. And somehow, you know, I think it's true in a lot of places that make the best coffees in the world where people are just... The average person is like, well, I'm not going to pay, I'm not going to compete in the global market for like these high quality beans. I'm going to just be happy with the instant. And but how, like, what is Kenyan coffee drinking culture like? Is there some proportion of the population that recognizes that Kenya makes some amazing coffee and kind of rolls with that? Or
The thing with Java House, they sort of made Kenyan coffee accessible to Kenyans, so to speak.
Yeah.
I would say maybe middle-class Kenyans. Before that, we were getting high on instant coffee, you know, and you were paying a pretty penny for coffee. Then Java opened up and you could realize, and they had baristas there making coffee, good food as well. And you're like, yeah, it's not too bad.
Yeah.
But we are a tea-drinking nation.
Uh-huh. So coffee is still the number two choice.
Coffee is number two. You go anywhere, people will offer you tea first. And not just tea bag tea, but brewed tea with milk. That is it. Coffee is, a smaller proportion of people drink coffee, and especially black coffee. I remember two previous jobs I had, there were a few of us who used to drink filtered coffee.
Okay.
Everyone else used to have instant. They said the coffee we used to make was too bitter.
Right. Yeah, yeah, that's right.
There's a word that my friend used to call it, I'll say it in Kiswahili if you don't mind, kahawa ya kutoa mimba. I don't know whether I will keep this, but she like coffee that terminates pregnancy.
So you're just like out there carrying a tray of miscarriage in a cup. Man.
I think there's someone at the door.
Oh, yeah. I'd ask the guy to go buy some cot. So I have been sort of internet stalking you and your various talks and interviews. You have a very entertaining and interesting media profile, I guess you would say.
Yeah, entertaining is an interesting word to you.
Well, I mean, a lot of it is like the kind of stuff that I would give me pause, like just getting up on stage, single person, telling a story, trying to hold an audience. But I'm, and you do it really well. And I'm kind of interested in how you got into that. Like, how did you decide, or maybe it just sort of fell into place that that this is what you were going to do, for a living.
I recently took on that label of a storyteller. I think this comes from my time at the BBC. And I've told people this, I consider myself a custodian of people's stories, even as a journalist. You know, people gave me their stories and I told them to the wider world. And I love hearing people's stories. So I think through everything, as a journalist, as an activist, as a podcaster, as a cancer survivor, and telling my own story, I think life sort of handed me what I'd been avoiding for a very long time, and now find myself doing it. And people actually say I tell stories pretty well.
Why had you been avoiding it?
I love and I don't love being on stage.
Hmm.
You know, I don't like the attention, but I know once I'm on stage, I become a whole new confident person and I feel comfortable on stage. And people, every time I'm up on stage, people are like, you look comfortable there. I used to act once upon a time. And yeah, the stage is also home and I'm now doing this. And I think over time, it's a question of valuing yourself. It's been a journey to actually get here and valuing my own story and realizing that I have a story to tell. And was it 2-3 years ago, I gave a talk on, it's like a TED version of Kenya called Engage.
Mm-hmm.
And I spoke about finding my voice. And that, I think, was turning point for me. I used to moderate quite a bit before that professionally. But now being on stage and telling people my own story and actually saying this is me finding my voice and sharing it and not feeling ashamed about whatever I have gone through has landed me now here with you.
Yeah. Man, well, I hope it doesn't, this, let's not make that an end point.
No.
This is a humble detour and I appreciate you.
And I realized that I like sitting in front of a mic. And when I used to work at the BBC and one of the requirements of the work as journalists was to perform in front of a microphone and on camera. And I realized this is cool stuff, man. I do like cans, I do like microphones, I do like, yeah, this the audio. I love audio, I love sound.
Well, let's talk about that because I guess, we're, obviously this is a medium that we've jumped into with great enthusiasm in podcasting. What is the state of podcasting in Kenya? Is it a word that people recognize? Is it... or is your audience both kind of local and international, or how do you look at podcasting in particular?
It's very interesting you should say that. As I was buying coffee, I met another podcaster, a guy called Amani, and
that's a very Brooklyn scene right yeah. there. It's just like, here we are at the coffee shop, just yeah. a couple podcasters, all right.
And he's recently got into podcasting as well. And he wants to bring other podcasters together. I would say Nairobi, it's a very Nairobi-centric thing,
mm-hmm.
and very middle class.
Okay.
you know, and because it's us having the liberty and the privilege to do this, to afford equipment like we have and to have the time. So, but it is growing. It is a small, it's very niche, if I might say. It's here in Nairobi and it's like
better than ever. Let's see how long it lasts. Hold out, battery. Yeah. Come on, little battery. So take me to that part about podcasting being kind of a luxury to have the equipment and the, you know, the time and the ability.
I wanted to get back into radio at one time. I'd missed audio, and I wanted to come up with content, you know, spoken word, and podcasting. And when I talked to people about it, they were like, you should go into podcasting. I'm like, no, I want to go back into mainstream radio. And then after some time, I figured this might be my avenue of going into mainstream radio. I believe in the spoken word, what's the term we used to use? Anyway, spoken word radio.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a big fan of that. NPR, BBC.
Right.
So, and that's my background. And I just like storytelling. And I figured this is a way of getting Kenyans to listen. I wanna go mainstream. But after some time, I realized, and speaking to other podcasters, that this might just be an avenue to explore.
Right.
Because I saw it as very niche. As you know, and
yeah.
And like everyone's doing podcasting in the States, in Europe, and you know, and it's not quite here. The audiences still listen to radio,
yeah,
and commercial radio, you know. And I wanted to, and I love public service radio. I really do, and I wanted to go back into that, but that didn't quite happen. Then started listening to podcasts, started meeting other Kenyan forerunners who I can. Forerunner podcasters, and liked what I was doing, and I realized this is something that I could do. Started buying kit, you know, good kit, listening to stuff on YouTube and tutorials. I went through quite a number of those, and came up with content. Hence Nipe's story. Initially, I wanted to have 4 podcasts. Then, after just trying 2, I realized this is a lot of work. So I scaled down to Nipe's story, which is my podcast. But in general, it's a very urban thing here in Nairobi. People are beginning to recognize what it has and coming up with a lot of niche content.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about the promise of podcasting. I guess you can find your audience, and it doesn't have to be that big, but they will, you know, they can be with you deeply because they can find something that's just specific for their taste. I also like, you know, from my short time here in Nairobi, I see tremendous opportunity in podcasting because it's all about cars and traffic and, you know,
absolutely.
The commute, you know.
So you
have like this, you just have so many human hours
in a car. You have already audience sitting in Nairobi traffic waiting to listen to stuff.
Waiting for Nipe's story. So tell me about that show. What is it trying to do, and how are you getting that done?
Nipe's story is just trying to get people into listening to stories, Kenyan stories, African short story fiction. I love stories. I love reading fiction. And yet again, I love listening to spoken word. And this was my way of just getting involved in that. It started in, I think, is it 28? I forget. December, November 2017.
Okay.
Just begging people for stories, begging people to voice stuff for me for free. I might just get in touch with you.
this is how podcasting survives, right?
Yeah.
It's the favor economy.
And I started off with 3, and the response was interesting. Well, actually overwhelming. People like, yeah, this is great. We need more of this. So that's what Nipe's story is. When I was a kid, I used to love listening to a program on radio called Maminosi's Story Time. It used to come on Tuesdays and Sundays. And she was a lady who used to just tell stories on radio.
Oh, man.
I loved it, mate.
That sounds so good.
I loved it. You know,
Nosi's Story Time.
Maminosi's Story Time. And even when I used to work in commercial radio, I used to love listening to the BBC. I loved news radio. I love listening to just different programs that were coming out of the World Service.
Can you still find Nosy Storytime online?
No, it's not. I mean, Nosy Storytime, no.
I feel like I'm trying to think, like, what, maybe we have Garrison Keillor, you know. I would love to trade. But anyway, we'll have to imagine what Nosy Storytime used to have been.
You know, so I was like, this is amazing. And I just want to, it's a simple goal, mate. Just to make people love listening to stories. And there's a lot of African creative writing going out there. And I'm hoping to provide a platform for that. And also for a lot of queer writing that doesn't get a platform. Especially in this form. So I just want to do that with Nipe's Story. I would love Nipe's Story to have a Pan-African feel.
Yeah.
First of all.
So that it could go across the continent and not just be for Kenyans.
Absolutely. And sometimes when I look at the stats, it's you get people listening in South Africa. But the thing that surprised me, there's a huge North American audience and a British audience as well. That surprises me.
Yeah. I don't know. I could see the appeal, especially because, you know, one, there's huge diaspora, and two, it is a different. I mean, I've gotten to listen to some of the episodes, and it's beautiful, and in the way that it, you know, the concerns are just different. The dialect, the accents are different. It's like transporting in some way, you know, as you know, if these were presented in, from a local perspective in the States. You could have a, you know, the same mission, the same mandate, but it's just very different the way that it plays and sounds and listens, and you can kind of lose yourself in it.
Thank you.
And it's interesting. I remember you did an interview in Berlin where you were sort of talking about the flip side of that, particularly talking about the context of I think queer film, where you were sort of saying, you know, there's some really great films that you saw at the Teddies, I think, where you were a judge, but that they didn't necessarily speak to you, like it was just a different experience because these are European or, you know, American filmmakers, was the sense that I got from that. And there is a way, you know, where your experience, it just does have a local identity to it, right? I mean, it's a very Kenyan thing, even though you have common cause with people who are trying to do fiction podcasts, with queer activists, you know, with people in different countries, but your experience is just going to be your own and fairly specific here. So I don't know. I'm interested in getting a sense from you, taking your temperature on where Kenya's at right now, in that particular realm, like queer activism, seems like a tough game right now.
People say it is, I don't consider it a really tough game because we've been here a long time. So we're used to this.
Yeah.
You know, I had drinks with a friend yesterday who's visiting also from the States, and he's like, it must be tough being gay. And it's a question these days I don't know how to answer.
Yeah.
Because I'm just doing my thing.
And you've always been here.
Yeah, I've always been here. Yeah. You know, some of my girlfriends are like, hook us up with single guys. I look at my phone book, I'm like, I don't know single guys. And if there are any single guys here, they're dicks, and I don't want to introduce you to them. My phone book is full of queer men and women, you know. And I've normalized that existence here.
Yeah.
But the fact that just almost a month ago, we lost a case in court that was trying to decriminalize gay sex.
Yeah.
You know, that was hurtful. That was painful.
Yeah. I mean, I spoke with Wanuri about this too. And I think, you know, especially for, you know, it's a 3-year legal battle, but even longer than that, I guess just an entire life of, you know, wishing this to be true.
But the fact that, mate, we were actually in court... you have to look at the positives. You know, I remember some of the comments that I got on my page. People were like, we're not coming to Kenya. We're going to boycott. I'm like, why? You know, we've been in this space for quite a while. And the fact that 10, 12 years ago, we never even thought that we would be in court.
Yeah.
But the fact that on the 24th of May, people showed up in court from all over, didn't care about the media glare, didn't care what people thought, but we were in court, mate.
Yeah.
That was powerful. And even before that, when the first time they postponed it, we had activists coming from Uganda, Tanzania, and Nigeria. Such was the magnitude of what we were doing. And I don't think it will stop us. The fact that now people know that queer people do exist in Kenya. They've always known, but the fact that we are coming out strong and like we're waving the flag next to the Kenyan flag and we are your brothers, your sisters, your sons, your daughters, your fathers, your husbands, your wives. We're like, it's a way of waking up Kenya to the reality that queer people are here and there's nothing you can do about it and we're as Kenyan as you are. So I think the space now and being involved with the Gay and Lesbian Coalition of Kenya and talking to people, it's now wanting to move that to dialogues and getting Kenyans to come out in support of us. And we've been preaching to the choir for quite a while, and it's now engaging other members of society and saying, yeah, you know, this is who we are. What do you want to know about us? How can you help? Such that when we do go back to court, we'd have other people speaking for us as well and not just ourselves.
Yeah.
That would be great. I mean, if you look at the case, Botswana luckily won theirs and people were making direct comparisons. I'm like, but you can't look at it that way. It's a very, this is the journalist coming out. It's a very simplistic way of looking at life. That story is not that simple.
Yeah.
But the fact that I was in Botswana last year and the deputy mayor, who's a man living with albinism, came and opened the largest Pan-African LGBT conference that had happened on the continent. The fact that he was there was a huge thing. And I remember sitting there, I'm like, would we even get someone from the city coming to attend one of this?
Yeah, you don't think Mike Sonko's showing up?
I don't think so, May. I don't think so, you know.
You're entertaining rapper-turned mayor of Nairobi.
No, let's not go there, man. He vexes my spirit, man.
Mike Money.
And that's how low we can go as a country.
That idea of building some sort of bridges to other parts of society so you're not out here fighting alone.
Absolutely, and then the fact that the president in Botswana gave out very positive statements about homophobia, saying that we can't be in this space, and other people have spoken. We have a president who still describes us as non-issues.
Right. Yeah, that's...
You know, so we need to get them to move from non-issues, but I keep on saying almost everything in Kenya is a non-issue. That's why we are the way we are. So we're just being lumped with everything else. Fight corruption, non-issue, you know?
So many amazing pressing issues that are actually non-issues.
Exactly.
Amazing.
So when that happened on Christian Amanpour on CNN, I told people, were like, oh, aren't you annoyed? I'm like, no, I'm not annoyed. The truth is a lot of things that should be dealt with in the country have been made non-issues. And we are being put into that category as non-issues with everything else.
The shit that's going down on Gong Road, non-issue.
Non-issue. The fact that no one's thinking, okay, let's put up bike lanes and make sure that there's street lighting. No one's, let's just put tarmac and make the road for people with cars. Forget about people with bicycles.
So you have joined the mainstream then by becoming a non-issue.
We are exactly that, you know. So that's where the space is at. I'm just hoping that the ruling has just made us as a movement stronger.
Yeah.
Will make us be a lot very introspective in how our strategy going forward will be.
Yeah.
And for me personally, I know it's made me bolder. Totally unapologetic about what I feel and the gay shit I'm putting out there on my face.
The Supreme Court has unleashed a wave of gay shit from Kevin's.
I mean, I wrote an article that's gone up on this platform called The Elephant.
Uh-huh.
They've been very kind in giving us opportunity to put queer stories out there.
Yeah.
There are two of my articles there. And I'm like, yes, we need, and as a journalist, I used to be slightly apologetic about it. And I'm I'm just going to put stuff, I'm just going to put the good journalist that I think I am, into this area where my energies are and where my life is involved in.
Yeah.
And come up with good journalism talking about queer Kenyans.
Yeah.
And what it is to be a queer Kenyan in Kenya.
It's when you, I think that it was a film festival or some sort of forum here that you were involved in that had the tagline, "The shame is a luxury we can't afford."
Absolutely.
But that's that kind of thing. It's like you, because certain things are stacked against you, you actually have to be bolder and brighter and kind of more out there. It seems to be your perspective on it.
I was telling someone, what do I have to lose now? My shit is out there. You know, and I think that's the way you take power from people. I've hung up my dirty laundry. I don't think it's that. I just use the expression. I've hang it there like, yeah, that's Kevo shit. Yeah. You know, so you can't say it. I've taken the power away from you.
Right. Right. This sort of constant, ongoing, you know, this is the experience I think that gay people have had for a long time in the States. It's like this daily blackmail.
Exactly. You know, and I've grown through a process and a journey, Nathan, where I didn't like myself pretty much. You know, I didn't think I was worth something to a point where I know what I'm worth and I'm happy about who I am in this space. You know, life has dealt me numbers, you know, thrown lemons at me and I've made lemonade, you know, and I'm dealing with that and moving on. You know, I was telling a friend yesterday, you only have one life.
Right. How are you going to spend it? Huh?
How are you going to spend it? And if this life is going to be used trying to make it easier for other queer individuals in Kenya, so be it, mate. And not just that, but also just trying to make the world a better place for other folk, man.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing also that I feel like people understand very little of. I mean, clearly by some of the conversations we're having in the United States is, you know, rights for LGBT, you know, sort of justice or rights for minority groups. It's not even about them. It's about you and like your, like, what kind of country are you going to be? And I'm sure Botswana is looking at it holistically as well, as like all these goals that they have as a nation, which include development, increased tourism, you know, a equal standing on the world stage. Like all of these things are hurt when they diminish the rights of, you know, some large percentage of their population. And, you know, we have that same conversation in the States. It's just like, it's not about being nice to gay people. It's about how, you know, about your quality of country. You
absolutely
know?
I think that, yeah, I like that. And just being nice to all people.
Yeah.
You know, being nice to women. You know, I think we as a country could do a much better job in being nicer to our women. You know, I don't know whether you've, slight digression here. You know, we still haven't fulfilled that constitutional quota that requires 25% representation of women.
Wow. Which isn't a big number.
It's not a big number, bruh. It's not a big number.
It's not totally proportionate, but yeah, even that is beyond reach somehow.
And that keeps on going back into parliament and it's not, I'm like, why aren't we passing this?
Yeah.
You know, that is basic. The fact that we're not doing shit to make life easier for people living with disability, for senior citizens, you know, for people living with albinism, you know, for other minorities apart from us.
Right. Yeah.
And I'm just hoping that if we win, we will win for other minorities. And I think for me, that is important.
Yeah.
This win is a win for other minorities in Kenya. And that's what we try telling people. People, and someone said, you know, the larger populace don't get it until they're affected.
Mm.
You know, one of the things I'm slowly getting onto another bandwagon is making, I don't know how I'm going to go about it, but advocating for the legalization of medicinal marijuana.
Okay.
You know, and people are like, no, you know, that is important. And I don't know whether you want to talk about it now or later, but as a cancer patient,
yeah,
that shit helps, man.
Yeah, yeah.
That shit helps. And if people can access it, and people don't, and someone was telling me Kenyans are not ready for it and will not advocate for it until they experience it. And I'm like, why do you have to experience it?
Yeah, I don't think they want to experience it. Like, you know,
yeah.
Just in order to have you become an educated voter, you have to go through a life-threatening bout of cancer. Yeah, fuck that. There's got to be an easier way to enlightenment.
Yeah, exactly. And I want to make life easier for people so that when you have to come across that hurdle or you know someone like, but here are options for you. We've done the work just so as to make this life easier for you. I mean, a week ago, a friend of mine also who's got multiple myeloma, one of the side effects of her treatment is shingles.
Oh, shit. That's a lot of pain. Yeah.
Bruh, I was on the phone with her. She was telling me what she's going through. And then I heard her screaming.
Yeah.
So for a minute, I just endured that. I was on my bike. It was the worst thing I had ever had. She screamed, mate. Called her husband and kept on screaming. Did my head a number, mate. I was so angry. I was so, so angry. I'm like, why doesn't someone like her have access?
Right.
Where doctors can say, don't go into morphine, don't go to this. Here's something that will ease your pain. And I just realized my cancer compared to her was a walk in the park.
Yeah, cancer comparisons. All right, well, let's get into that. I always like, we started this podcast with a cancer episode, which was about me, which was the cancer that I had had. And I haven't had a really good cancer conversation since
then. Let's have a good cancer conversation if you want to.
Yeah, because that was, among your multiple identities and kind of, voices that you bring to the work that you do. I think you got this very unwelcome addition to the trophy case. I don't know. That's probably a terrible metaphor. But
it is what it is.
It is what it is. So tell me about that. When did this happen? It was not long ago.
I got diagnosed with multiple myeloma, which is a blood cancer, in 2015.
Oh shit. Okay.
In October 2015.
And I have to say, I don't know. I had the walk in the park cancer, the actual walk in the park.
Which one was that?
I had a thyroid cancer.
Okay.
So it's just I didn't even get sort of classic chemo, but it was a radiation treatment, and it was weird and it sucked and it was frightening, but ultimately it was a very different experience. Oh, hang on 1 second. Charles is back. So tell me, is multiple myeloma?
It's a cancer that affects the plasma.
Jesus.
In your blood.
That sounds grave.
I don't know when people say that I'm here, man. My doctor says ignorance is bliss, and maybe I was just blissfully ignorant through that whole process. I still don't get into the technicalities of my cancer because I'm like, I don't understand this shit. I'm not a doctor.
Yeah.
Just give it to me in the way I that I would understand. When people talk about, and I meet other survivors and they're talking about this count. I'm like, man, I'm just sour. This is the central reading I look for and that is it. All these other bits and my brain just can't process that, to be honest.
Yeah.
I just can't. I'm like, this is the main thing. Fine. And I'm good.
So you had the diagnosis. What is the treatment process like?
I went through chemo for 6 months.
Jesus Christ.
Went to India for a stem cell transplant. Was in India for 7 months. And I've been in partial remission and now in remission since I got back in, since 2016, so to speak. Proper remission last year. I'm on what they call maintenance treatment, where I take an immunosuppressant, so to speak, a drug rather, every day for 21 days. I get a week off and then I start again. So I'm on round or cycle number, I think 39 or something.
Wow. That's like, that's a number that you could scratch on the walls of your prison cell. Right?
Exactly.
You have made it that far. Wow. So that's an entire year between, the chemo here and stem cell in India, and it's just an entire year to take to try to survive this and beat that. What is that? I mean, how do you restart your life after that?
The thing is, mate, I lost my favorite aunt to cancer just around the same time I was diagnosed.
I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah.
And I figured once the doctor said, that the mood from my surgeon to an oncologist, and when he initially told me about the diagnosis, it could be, I think it was pulmonary TB or something, or multiple, it was one disease or multiple myeloma. I keep on telling people, it's like being on a plane and the stewardess tells you, tea or coffee? We're out of tea, so there's only coffee. So it was, and that sort of made it easier for me to accept this. So when the doctor said, you've tested negative for this, I knew, okay, it's myeloma. And it's
so you were served the coffee.
Yeah, so it was...
The bitter coffee.
The bitter coffee. And the moment that... And my mom's other sister had died of breast cancer.
Oh, man.
So I remember
sitting... God, your poor mother, huh?
Yeah. I remember sitting... And they had just buried my Aunt Judy when all this had happened. And I figured, not me. I'm like, this shit has to change. I'm like, I will not be another number. I will not be another funeral service. Not because of cancer, and not yet. And that instantly changed for me. I figured, I'm going to fight this shit. That was it. But I figured, no, I will not let this scourge attack win in our family again. And I think through that whole process, my writing had sort of gone into habitation, hibernation rather. And I think I just started taking control and just being open about my disease. And I think coming out really helped. You know, I figured I'm just going to put my shit out there for people to understand.
So this was, you came out at the same time that you started talking about having cancer?
No, I'd come out before.
Okay.
But that whole
it's practice.
Being stigmatized, ostracized, like, oh my God, you know, I'm like, I've already gone through that process where people sort of other you for some reason or the other, you know? So I'm like, I'm just going to make sure that if anyone wants to know what I'm going through, that they are all reading from the same song sheet.
Yeah.
Taking control of your narrative. So I started blogging, and I blogged my journey through treatment. I still blog every now and then about cancer, but I just wanted to make sure that everyone was getting the right script, the right story. And because our family and friends scattered all over, and bro, you can only answer so many phone calls.
Yeah.
and so many WhatsApp messages. So I'm like, what's other things? Just go into the blog.
Yeah. Like, right.
All that shit, everything is there.
Yeah. I have a friend who's fighting cancer, which is very intense right now, and she's doing the same. It's just there's a site that is, I forget the name of the site, but it's really powerful. She can, you know, say what she has to say once, and then there's also ways that people can sign up to like bring a meal over or like do any of these things. So it's sort of like integrated help telling the story, help, you know, not being distracted by having to retell it, and then also help with the things you need. I don't know. I'm kind of fascinated. When I got diagnosed, to me, it felt like it taught me something, and maybe I took the wrong lesson, or it's just for me, but taught me something about, for example, social media, because I had been, you know, I think I'd been on social media quite a bit, or on Facebook and, you know, whatever, pictures of my kids, some shit I was doing overseas when I was working, all of this stuff. And for some reason, I had a very visceral kind of allergic reaction against talking about cancer while I was going through it. And I don't know if it was the uncertainty of it and just, you know, not wanting to talk about things I didn't know. I didn't know how the story was going to end. I will say, I mean, obviously, when we launched this podcast with Bourdain, the first episode was, you know, ultimately about me having cancer. So it's not like I was shy about it in the long term, but just in the moment while I was going through it, I just felt like, you know, it gave me a sense of the people around me who knew me and were, you know, family and close friends, felt like the people who would help me through this. And I haven't really gone back to social media in that same way afterwards, because it just felt like, I felt like, well, if it's not something that works for me in a moment like this, then what actually is it besides, you know, kind of lifestyle marketing? It's impressive, but it's also something that I just didn't have the same ability to be there in real time talking about it.
I think for me, I like the word you said, it's a lifestyle marketing or something, a campaign.
Yeah.
I figured if we're going to use social media to put on our good, why not put on our bad?
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Because, you know, that's life, man. You know, it can't be me at fantastic places in the country or on the continent or around the world, you know, taking trips and everything and meeting people. That's not life, man. This is life. This is me dealing with this shit publicly.
Yeah.
Just to tell you this, I've been dealt with a number. And also the fact that I realize I've got family in the States, got family in the UK. You know, I've got close friends in different parts of the world who did care.
Yeah.
And because of the way healthcare is in Kenya, I needed money for treatment.
Yeah, right.
And there was a GoFundMe campaign as well.
Yeah.
You know, and there was that. So my stories helped complement that.
Yeah.
And people needed a story if they were going to give money.
Yeah, right.
That story was mine.
There is a national health system here. But you need money to perform it well, I guess. Or
it is. There's public health, but accessing some of those services, things have changed, I would say, fortunately, within the last 3 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
But back in 2015, when I was diagnosed, I remember when Professor Riyad, who's my doctor, was telling me about the treatment options. He gave me like 4 options, this is it, and like costs. You know, I was willing to just put all my savings. I'm like, this is what I have in the bank. This will see me through 3 months. And
yeah.
Then, and I didn't want to put my family through that.
Yeah.
And I remember my dad saying, "Don't worry, we'll find a way." And I met my friend, my boy, who also had breast cancer. She was like, "Cancer makes you guilty." And I felt guilty. I'm single man, gay. I'm in hospital again. You know, I'd been in hospital twice that year before. And I'm like, yeah, it's you again putting your family through this shit. And I'm like, now, how are we going to afford it? That the amount of drugs I was spending, the cost of what I was spending in a month was equivalent to my salary.
Yeah.
And I have to go through 6 months of chemo. My insurance almost was going to run out, I think, a month after being discharged from hospital. So you're like, We need to, and I have to go for a transplant. How much a transplant? It's like $2,500 or no, $25,000 for a transplant.
My goodness.
On the higher end.
Yeah.
You're like, man.
And that was in the Indian.
That was in India.
Health system. So you have to go there and then also live and
So it was thinking all those things and trying to deal with the guilt, and being alone, and then. Yeah, and lumbering your family with this cost that they have to carry with you as well.
And that is such a, you know, it's a very quintessentially American story that you've just told. And it's funny, I was talking with one of the Uber guys who had just gotten hit just a little bit in a parking lot before he came and picked me up. And he had this like fresh scratch and, you know, and he spent the ride telling me about insurance here, about car insurance. And he's like, yeah, well, you know, things are really messed up here. Like, you know, you pay into car insurance and they never really pay out. So we always just handle stuff in cash. And isn't that messed up? And I was like, well, that's kind of exactly how it goes in the States too.
I think there's a yes or no to that. It's faster, you know, decide paying out instead of waiting for 3 months to get.
Yeah.
You know.
But it is you know, it's not something that either country should take pride in, that these are, you know,
indeed,
the way that health insurance and health costs, I mean, a single illness can bankrupt an entire generation. In the United States, and it's just facts. I mean, it's a terrible thing because you're also dealing, obviously, with, you know, preservation.
Exactly.
At the same time.
Exactly. And you know, and when the doctor says my cancer doesn't have a cure, you're like, this is long term.
Yeah.
Right. This is long term. I have to start thinking of how not to lumber my family with this burden, and how I'm going to see myself through this. So going back to the whole social media, it also made the journey easier as well. Just receiving, one of the things I struggled with, and I saw a therapist for over 2 years, and she told me is learn to receive kindness.
Mm.
And I bet you must have experienced kindness from all quarters.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't get a lot of the other, I didn't get a lot of people who were like, good.
Yeah.
So, you know, whatever soundtrack you have, you know, your own self-criticism, it is nice to just be in a completely, you know, a completely supportive environment in that sense.
Absolutely.
So
I got a lot of kindness from all quarters, from strangers and none, you know, and the fact that my story was helping other people go through that.
Yeah.
And as a Kenyan man, and use the word generally, as African men, we don't talk about illness very openly.
Hmm.
You know, I just knew by talking about this will help deal with the stigma of surrounding illness, surrounding cancer, you know, and just telling people you can go through this.
And is it like a stoicism, or why is it, does it feel like a personal failing, or what's the backdrop for Kenyan?
I just think it's that whole element of masculinity where you don't want to show your weakness.
Right.
You know, people don't man flu things. You know, you will not go to the hospital until, like, you don't have to wait for this to happen until it's really bad for you to go to the hospital. you know, get there early, get checked early.
Yeah.
You know, take your health seriously. And I was hoping I was trying to do that.
Yeah.
And not feel ashamed about going through what I was going through and just being open about it. Women are a lot more open about their health challenges.
Yeah.
I think we need to learn a lot from that, at least in this part of the world. You know, women have to go. The reality of breast cancer hits them almost every day. Check your breasts, look for lumps. You know, they all know that. When was the last time you checked your balls?
That's a good question. Yeah. Probably when I was going through this, when they were like, yeah,
exactly,
wondering where the cancer had gotten to.
I'm asking you, and I'm like, I can't remember the last time I checked mine either. But we sort of have to take,
right. Yeah.
Take ownership of that.
Yeah.
Every woman would have to check for a lump.
All right.
Oh, as often as they can.
Listeners, let's get this started. Listeners, check your balls.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's actually true, and it's you know, these public health campaigns can, you know, they can feel sporadic. They tend to adhere to like a single wealthy donor's, you know, pet illness and something, but they really do, you know, they can just put that little thought in your brain.
Yeah.
And it is, I mean, that was one of the things about getting cancer is you do, it's almost like walking through a veil of like, you know, a moment where you are just living and you feel, you know, in shape or out of shape, but you're generally healthy and you don't even question any of it, to a kind of irreversible change in perspective where you realize just the, you know, the weakness of the flesh, the, you know, the
frailness of the body.
Yeah. And it does change your perspective, you know, pretty completely.
I mean, going back to that period, people didn't believe I was the guy who had cancer because I was fit.
Yeah.
The previous year I was doing marathons. I was attempting to attend the Comrades Marathon in South Africa, which is an 18, I don't know what it is in miles, 89 kilometer road race.
Wow.
From Pietermaritzburg to Durban or vice versa. You know, that's like maybe, well, isn't it 40 miles or something?
Yeah, that's a long ass marathon.
Yeah, yeah. So I was that guy. I was that guy. I remember when I was in hospital being checked up, the nurses would ask me whether I was an athlete because everything was fine.
Yeah, Jesus.
I was in my best form physically.
I was also running marathons before I got diagnosed. Maybe the marathons obviously cause cancer. Let's also put that out there in the ether.
I like that. So everyone's like, you yeah. can't be the guy. You're the guy who lives healthy, and you're the guy now in hospital dealing yeah. with cancer. Some people are like, no, it should not be you, and like it is.
Yeah.
And for me, it's like, yeah, it's happened. And a few doctors were like, you know, thank God you looked after your body.
Yeah.
And my friend Mary, who I was angry, mate. I was angry for the first few weeks and I couldn't understand. I'm like, I've done everything right and now I have to deal with this. And Mary just sort of helped put it into perspective that it's like, you're lucky that your body's now going to fight for you. You've looked after it. Changed instantly.
Yeah.
Changed. And gratitude, mate. I would shower and pat myself and say, thank you. Thank you. You know, I'd have conversations with my body. I still do. And like, bro, let's just get through this.
Yeah.
You know, so I started looking after my body even better because I figured you need to see me through this, mate.
That's interesting. I that feels extremely healthy from a mental perspective as well. I don't think I had necessarily the same response. I still, you know, I my reaction to stress or crises tends to be to live a little wild.
I think that there is there's a time like that, but
yeah.
I mean, it takes me 2-3 days now to get over a hangover, and I'm like, I apologize, like I'm so sorry, but that was a good night, you know, you know.
Yeah.
But I think we should allow ourselves that. Like I said, you only have this life.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's a question of balancing.
Yeah. You know? No, and it does, the pendulum swings, for sure. And I've definitely, you know, one of the things since Bourdain's suicide, you know, is just going to a sharp, you know, sort of, ascent to, the mountaintop of, you know, kind of, overdoing it. And then kind of like gradually just working back down, in a way that I think, may be getting closer toward where you've arrived by natural disposition of just, you know, kind of trying to take care of yourself and giving yourself a little bit of credit for having made it this far, right?
I mean, I use running. I used to use a lot of running analogies to describe my journey.
Yeah.
You know, it's like just get through kilometer per kilometer, and that was it.
Yeah.
Kilometer per kilometer. When you hit the wall, it's like, yeah, fuck this shit.
Yeah.
You know, and then overcoming the wall.
Well, I mean, if marathons didn't cause cancer, which I think we figured out they do, then I would be more in support of that analogy.
But it helped me get through it, bro.
Yeah.
It helped me get through it.
Well, to use the marathon analogy, I think we've hit the finish line.
Already?
I know, so soon. But I am like, I would encourage everybody to kind of go and see some of the work that you've put out there, to listen to Nipe's story, to listen to your talks, which are, you know, really just kind of very moving and paced in this really beautiful way. And I think it's a great way of experiencing kind of the Kevin that we've had on this show. And I really appreciate you spending the time.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for coming down to Kenya, man.
We're here. Well, we're in Karen.
It's still Kenya. This is a really nice part of Kenya.
All right. Thank you, Kevin.
Cheers.
The Trip from Roads and Kingdoms is hosted by me, Nathan Thornburg. Emily Marinoff was our producer on this episode, Taffy Mokinyatsi our consulting producer. Alexa Van Sickle is our editor at RNK. Music by Dan the Automator. Episode illustration by Daisy D. Show artwork by Adele Rodriguez. Executive producers are me and Matt Goulding, also of Roads and Kingdoms. Next week is our last in Nairobi, and we are going out with a bonafide star. Muthoni Drummer Queen is beloved in Kenya. Every time I mentioned I would be talking to her, faces just lit up all around me. You will find out why next week on The Trip. We will meet you there.